years, a Dixon comptroller managed to embezzle almost $54 million from the struggling Illinois town.
By day, she's wearing municipal clothes, and by night, she's dripping with jewels and furs.
A new film sheds light on what one state's attorney has called the biggest theft of public funds in Illinois history. Plus, just 2 months after state regulators approved the first fracking permit for the state, the company has called off its plans. We'll speak with that company, environmental activists, and the mayor of Enfield. And although the veto session has ended, the war of words between Governor Rauner and some Democratic politicians continue. We'll get you up to speed on what's happening in Illinois politics. It's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Every year, the State House spends some time revisiting bills that were nixed by the governor. It's known as the veto session. And this year, it didn't go exactly the way many leaders had planned. It started when hundreds of women in politics released an open letter detailing a culture of sexual harassment in Springfield. Later on, an advocate named Denise Rothheimer accused Senator Ira Silverstein of sexually harassing her for months while he was sponsoring one of her bills. This also put a spotlight on the office that investigates these type of complaints in the Capitol, an office, as it turns out, had been left empty for the past 4 years until last week. Meanwhile, the General Assembly overrode 17 of Governor Rauner's vetoes. Some high-profile bills didn't make the cut, including one bill that would have banned local municipalities from creating so-called right-to-work zones. All of that said, there's a lot to get into this Monday morning after all of this is over. As we do every week, we're talking state politics. We're joined by two reporters to help us understand what's going on behind the headlines. Natasha Karecki writes the Illinois Playbook for Politico. She's on the line from Chicago, from Decatur. Tom Lisi is the government watchdog reporter for the Herald and Review. Tom, Natasha, welcome back to the 21st. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Natasha, maybe we can start with you. Before we get to all of the bills, is there such a thing as a normal veto session? And would you call this year's veto session normal by any standards?
It wasn't. I mean, it's not normal at all. I would say Rauner, Governor Rauner had, a bunch of bills that were up before the legislature that he had, vetoed. And I think he just picked his battles. He put all his eggs in one basket. He really wanted this right to work veto to stand. That was a direct hit on him with the legislature passing this in the first place. It was meant to undermine his legal efforts in the past to try to get the Supreme Court to look at right to work for local municipalities in Illinois and elsewhere. And so this would have undermined that effort. He did manage to fend off, the legislature from by exactly one vote in the House. He was able to win that effort.
Natasha, can you just explain what the right to work, just for folks who may not familiar? I think everyone hears that term all the time, but can you explain how it relates to labor unions and organizing, and in this case, public state municipal or local municipalities?
Sure. Some people say that the right to work is essentially it means that you do not have to join a union. You don't have to pay dues to a union if you want to get a government contract or other kind of contracts within certain areas. Now, some states do this statewide, and in Illinois, what Governor Rauner was proposing was having local municipalities give them the ability to pass local ordinances and allow them to do this, like Lincolnshire did this. You don't have to bid out to a union for certain contracts. It can be, and you don't have to pay. And also it tackles membership dues and payment of union dues. So essentially this is Rauner's big battle. He's very anti-union, and he believes that is what's driving some of the jobs from Illinois, is that government union jobs have been driving up costs, and he's trying to rectify that through this. So this was his big kind of war on unions.
Right, and this was his big war on unions. And Tom, can you just remind us again how this will now affect labor unions throughout the state?
Well, basically, you know, I think the prevailing wisdom is that it won't too much. Even if the legislation would have been overridden, it probably wouldn't have much of a daily impact, because, you know, the idea of setting up a right to work zone in a municipality or a local government in Illinois is still a pretty big lift. You know, unions are still very, very powerful politically in the state. And so unless, you know, it would still be really, really hard to do on a state-wide basis, too. So, you know, it was really, I think, in a large sense, a symbolic victory for Governor Rauner. I know he's interested in a court case that's, I believe, happening on the federal level of,
the Supreme Court. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of making, you know, right to work basically nationwide. So, you know, this is really something that Governor Rauner really believes can help bring down costs for local governments. That's something he really, really believes is, you know, part of, you know, bloated expenses in the public sector. So this has always been a big thing for him.
And Natasha, what does this give Governor Rauner? As you said, this has always been his big battle. This has always been his issue since he's taken office, that he wants to dismantle unions. What does this win give for him in a practical sense versus I imagine how much he's going to talk about this on the campaign trail? I wonder if you can give us the reality first.
The reality versus politics. Well, the reality is, you know, he is hoping, you know, assuming that the Supreme Court does follow through, you know, hears the case and does rule in his favor, you know, it's a blow to union membership. I mean, you might see if union members are not compelled to pay their dues, if they're not compelled to join a union in certain areas, then it diminishes their power. And that is something that he has sought to do. So that just in an immediate reality, that is something that's possible, not immediate right now, but if the Supreme Court rules in that favor, that's what he has wanted, you know, that's what he's sought to do politically. You know, Rauner is having a tough time finding wins after the last couple years. We've had all these issues with the legislature and the budget impasse. This is something tangible that he can go to his, you know, more conservative base, such as his, or go out on the campaign trail and say, hey, I was able to not only knock out the supermajority in the House, that means my vetoes aren't overridden. This is something that's important to some businesses, and he can go back on the campaign trail and say, look, I kept this. This is a win.
We're talking Illinois politics with Natasha Korecki from Politico and Tom Lisi with the Herald and Review Indicator, where he's a government watchdog reporter. Natasha, can I ask you, in terms of wins, you were talking about Governor Rauner. I'm thinking about Comptroller Susana Mendoza and Governor Rauner have not been on, obviously, she's a Democrat, haven't been on great terms for what seems like a very long time. This round, they've been fighting over a bill that she's pushing called the Debt Transparency Act, which he vetoed, but the state house came back and overrode by an overwhelming margin. Can you explain to us just what this debt transparency bill is? This seems like a lot of, I guess, very inside government kind of machinations. But why has this become such a important fight between the two of them?
Well, you know, for one thing, you know, it's inside machinations, but not so much in the sense that I think the average person in Illinois at least has some sense that we were at this budget impasse for a couple of years. We weren't paying our bills on time. We have $16 billion in a bill backlog. Susana Mendoza was able to convince almost the entirety of the legislature was that, hey, the way that different agencies report their bills right now and their backlogs and how much they owe is ridiculous. We only find out once a year when they're compelled to tell us. So you can suddenly have, oh my gosh, we owe $2 billion more than we thought. Whereas this bill would require monthly reporting, and it just would give a more up-to-date, and as she says, transparent look at where our finances are in more real time. And so that is, you know, the essence of Mendoza's argument. You know, now Rauner, even after he was, you know, it was a resounding defeat, he still said that he didn't think it was a good bill, that instead we should put money into our, you know, digital system and into some of the IT infrastructure and give us reporting in real time, as in, you know, day to day, minute to minute kind of stuff. So it has created a very interesting clash there once again between the two of them.
Right. And Tom, I'm thinking about this. Comptroller Susana Mendoza was on the program right after the General Assembly passed the budget. I recall her saying very clearly that she said she doesn't think there's any way to repair the broken trust between herself and Governor Rauner and Democrats and Governor Rauner. And after she criticized him last week about $1 billion in past due bills, the governor said, quote, Comptroller Mendoza criticizing an unbalanced budget that the Democrats passed and that she worked on is like the bank robber calling the police and saying, we have a problem. Both of you guys, if you could just weigh in here, Tommy, if you can start. How does this affect taxpayers when the governor and comptroller are kind of in this public war?
Well, Susana Mendoza came in. She beat Leslie Munger, who was handpicked by Rauner. She was the previous comptroller, and she's really that was the a couple of years ago, and she's come in kind of guns blazing. She's really been on the forefront and really been very, very active and very effective, frankly, at going to going into the public and really fighting Rauner tooth and nail, and I think Rauner really just had just a really, really bad summer. And, you know, part of that, I think, was he had switched up his staffing a couple times, and it just got really muddied, and some of his vetoes were – some of the reasoning was a little strange and hard to follow. And I think Democrats and Mendoza sort of took the lead in a lot of ways, sort of capitalized on that. And so, you know, when the House overrode the Governor Rauner's veto, it was a unanimous vote. So, I mean, for Rauner to still sort of fight on this, it's a strange theater to watch with really no one in his own caucus backing him up on this.
Right. Natasha, correct me. It was 3 no votes total, right, between the House and the Senate on this?
Right. House unanimously no, and the Senate, he was able to get 3 no votes on. I do think that number of people voting against it in his own party, you know, sort of contradicts his contention that this is political, that, you know, Mendoza is just, you know, a bank robber. And I think it ends up making him look both political when he makes that argument at the same time that most of his party is agreeing with her. It's a difficult one. To sort of figure out where, you know, it's a transparency bill. It's something that he, you know, he maybe would have been better off putting his efforts elsewhere.
We've got a couple minutes left. I want to get back to the ongoing news around sexual harassment in the Capitol. We've talked on the program about the allegations against Democratic Senator Ira Silverstein. I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, Denise Rothheimer saying in a public hearing that he harassed her for months. Since then, 444 pages of Facebook messages have been released, and there's been a lot going on in the Capitol. Can I ask Natasha first, what's the current status of this specific allegation against a sitting state senator?
Well, right now we finally do have a legislative inspector general, Julie Porter, former federal prosecutor, and she will be taking that on. It had been sitting that the complaint against Ira Silverstein had been sitting there for a year, and lots of the laws had to be changed just to kind of hold up the statute of limitations on that complaint and others. So now it is in the hand of the IG's office, and that is what you know, Silverstein has kind of said. You know, there's been some calls for his resignation, and he said, look, let, you know, give me my due process, let her take it up, and let's see what, you know, the IG's office says. And Rothheimer still wants a hearing, and she, you know, she said it's been a year since I've brought this complaint. I just want to be heard, and I want to put this behind me.
Tom, last week we also saw the creation of a bipartisan women's caucus. Can you explain a little bit? Can you maybe share with us what stood out to you about that news conference last week?
Right. Yeah. So some women senators announced that they were forming a women's caucus in the Senate. And, you know, I think maybe to some people that might be surprising that that didn't already exist. And there isn't one in the House, and I think there's been a little bit of discussion about maybe that happening. But, you know, last year when things were really at a standstill, when it was between, you know, Governor Rauner and, you know, Democratic lawmakers, the caucus leaders trying to hammer out a budget finally, you know, there was some, discussion that the women lawmakers were really just talking with each other at this point, and I think they kind of felt like that they were really better equipped at sort of coming to compromises and not doing all this sort of political infighting. And there was sort of this, you know, I remember Senator Toy Hutchinson saying, she's a Democrat, saying that, you know, if women were in charge, you know, this budget would have been passed 2 years ago, you know. So I think amidst all this sexual harassment allegations and the sort of cultural moment we're in right now, I think it this sort of forming of a caucus that is bipartisan. There are.
Yeah, Tom, I'm going to have to stop you there. I'm afraid we're out of time, but I want to thank Tom Lisi and Natasha Kerecki for being with us. Thanks, guys. Listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Back in 2013, lawmakers and concerned citizens all over the state debated the pros and cons of fracking. That's the oil drilling practice of hydraulic fracturing, which we often call fracking. So when Illinois finally passed laws to make fracking legal, it was considered one of the strictest standards in the country. 2 months ago, state regulators approved the first fracking plan in Illinois. But now that company, Woolsey Operating, is calling off their plans. Woolsey had intended to drill a horizontal fracking well in Enfield, that's in southeastern Illinois. But the Kansas-based company recently sent a letter to the Illinois Department of Natural Resources saying it had decided to withdraw its permit in White County, citing the state's, quote, burdensome and costly regulations. We're going to be speaking with the Enfield Village president in a moment. But first, I'm joined by Mark Suter. He's Woolsey's vice president of business development. Mark, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks, Nyla. Thanks for having us today.
Now, you all are based in Kansas. What made you decide on Enfield and particularly southeastern Illinois for this venture initially?
Well, we made an intensive geological and geophysical study looking at the New Albany Shale as a potential resource play. And we selected, our study was out throughout the Illinois Basin, which includes Illinois, Indiana, and parts of Kentucky. And after our studies, which included drilling some vertical wells in the New Albany Shale, coring 9 wells, shooting 3D seismic, completing our study, we felt like that the infield area was a good place for us to drill the first horizontal test well in Illinois. We also had previously drilled a horizontal well in Posey County, Indiana, just across the Wabash River in Indiana, and had some results from that well, and we felt like the next best place for us to go was the site that we picked there just north of Enfield.
Right, Mark. So it sounds like a pretty extensive process. I wonder, what was the time frame of how long you all spent getting, not just doing all of that, but getting the permit approved and those sorts of things?
Well, we started our studies at the end of 2011. Started buying oil and gas leases in 2012. And through that time, we were drilling wells and doing our studies. We started the permitting process for our Woodrow 1H well there in Enfield. Probably in April of 2016 is when we really started the work on filing a permit.
I see. And then it was 2 months from that before, if I'm getting the time frame correctly here, before you guys decided to withdraw the permit and abandon the plans. Why?
Well, it's a business decision that we had to make, and it was a difficult decision for us to make because of the time and resources that we'd spent there in Illinois. But when we looked at things like the consideration of the current price of oil and gas, which when we started in the play, the oil prices were much higher than what they are today. The regulatory environment in Illinois, which is the rules, as you stated, were probably the most stringent in the nation, or at least one of the most stringent in the nation. That regulatory environment, and then also us being a small company, we had to consider other exploration opportunities that we had in other states. So those three things, the price of oil and gas, the regulatory environment in Illinois, and our opportunities we had in other states, we came to the conclusion that it would be the best thing for our company to suspend our operations there in Illinois for drilling horizontal wells.
Right. Mark, you mentioned the regulatory environment. It's our understanding that Woolsey had also been cited with about a dozen violations over the past 4 years for issues at traditional vertical oil and gas wells. Did any of these citations play a role also when deciding to not go forward with your operations?
Not at all.
Not at all. Okay. And are you what you did send a letter to the Illinois Department of Natural Resources? What kind of response did you get? I imagine, obviously, to your mind, not satisfactory in terms of continuing operations.
Well, the letter that we sent to the department, the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, I don't know exactly what letter you're referring to. We just sent a letter there requesting that they would withdraw our permit.
And did you get any response back from the DNR?
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, yeah, they responded back to us with a letter that said that they did withdraw our permits for the Woodrow 1H well, so at this point, we are decided not to go forward drilling that.
Right. You mentioned costs involved. How much of an investment was this for you all?
Well, we've had in the basin itself when we started all of our studies, it's several million dollars is what we spent in the Illinois Basin. That included drilling the wells, geophysical studies, lease bonuses for mineral owners in the state. So we have several million dollars invested in it. One of the considerations that we had to make in withdrawing our permit was just the cost of filing the permit in Illinois, and that not only in financial resource, but also in human resources and the time that it took, and comparing it to other states that we do business in, mainly in Kansas. We, at this point, probably have about $75,000 in the process of just filing the permit. If we go to Kansas, which we have some exciting exploration plays that we are undertaking now in Kansas, the cost of filing a permit for a horizontal well would be in a few hundred dollars. So looking at that cost was also a consideration that we made, not only in particularly in looking at future developments.
Do you all have a sense that Woolsey, any sense that you all will be in Illinois doing, or at least for fracking? Do you think that that's over for you guys?
Well, at this time, I think it is. If the price of oil and gas would increase, that might mean that we would come back. But also, I think that we would have to look at possibly getting some new legislation or rule changes that would make it more business friendly for us to conduct our operations there in Illinois.
It's Mark Suter. He's Vice President of Business Development for Woolsey Operating Companies. They're based in Kansas, where he joined us from. Mark, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Nyla.
For more perspective on this, we're joined now by Enfield's Village President, Tom Harbor. He's on the line with us. Tom, we know everyone in Enfield calls you the mayor, right? So, Mayor, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks
All
for being
right.
with me.
Thank you. Thank you.
How many jobs are we talking about here, Mayor? I know when you were on the 21st previously, you were very optimistic about the impact this might have for Enfield's economy.
Well, I don't think that the employment would have been too big right to start, but if their entire project would have taken hold, if Woolsey's future plans after this first well, there would have been several jobs. And then also, I believe, they had a local contractor. Woolsey had a local contractor that was going to do the well drilling, and they would have local people working. So
were you surprised at the fact that they pulled out? Was this a surprise to you?
Somewhat, yes. I was surprised when I heard it. One of my friends had mentioned it to me, and I didn't believe him, you know. And then there was a news story a few days later, and sure enough, it was over, you know.
Yeah. We're speaking with Enfield's Village President, Tom Harbor. I want to also welcome one other person to this conversation. Josh Morgerman is with me in our studios in Chicago. He's a national media director for the Natural Resources Defense Council. Hi, Josh. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
So, Josh, you are one of the several organizations that oppose this initial application. Why was that?
It is really surprising that Woolsey decided to pull out, because this application was pretty shoddy. We were surprised by the amount of information that was required to be present that wasn't. There were a lot of gaping holes, and we were frankly surprised that the state approved the permit. This was the first permit approved under Illinois' rules, passed in 2013, and we thought it set a pretty bad precedent because it was lacking. The only thing that surprised us more was Woolsey deciding to walk away once they'd already gone through that process.
And so what's your reaction to you hearing the company saying that you're saying that they didn't even go through the whole application process, but they're saying the whole application process was very burdensome and costly, and the regulatory environment in Illinois is just not conducive to them doing business right now?
Those are all odd things to say once you've gone through the process and been awarded the permit. He noted burdensome regulation, and that's a comment we've heard a lot about. But I think the other factor that he pointed to that has a lot more to do with this is the cost of the price of oil right now. I think they're making a very clear calculation on the return on investment, and it has a whole lot more to do with the economics than it does on any sort of burdensome regulations. I think that's just an excuse.
Mayor Tom, where does this leave Enfield? I mean, what are folks in town saying? What were you hoping was going to happen?
Well, the majority of people in town were wanting this project to be successful, and they're right now they're kind of waiting for another day now. You know, our little community, we're only 594 people. And any money that would come into the community would have helped with a lot of things. And I was hoping, you know, for increase in fuel purchases and our restaurants and then some employment, and then maybe a little farther down the road if there would have been another well drilled, maybe a few more people.
Right. So an overall economic impact, as well as, it sounds like, much needed injection of capital into your town. Josh, you're sitting here nodding. I wonder, from the NRDC's perspective, as you think about you all sort of challenging fracking companies and kind of traditional fossil fuel companies, what your response is when you're hearing towns like Enfield, where they desperately need these jobs?
Well, I don't want to get in the way of people working, but I do want to make sure that any of those jobs that are produced are not done in a way that threatens the local economy through other impacts. There have been all kinds of concerns raised and bad examples of impacts from hydraulic fracturing in other states that don't have the sort of protections that we have here in Illinois. Impacts on public health, impacts on water supplies, concerns about seismicity. Those are all things that we have to weigh and think about here in Illinois. The fact of the matter is, this company was given a permit, so the burdensome regulations and burdensome process that they're complaining about, those complaints don't hold true in this case.
And do you actually think, what's the NRDC's opinion, Josh, of the fracking law that was passed in 2013?
Well, we supported a ban on fracking bill previous to that in the Illinois General Assembly that didn't go anywhere. We actually participated in the negotiations that helped develop the rules that were passed in 2013. We stand behind them and support them. And the fact of the matter is that we think that there are other energy industries that offer significantly more opportunities to the state of Illinois that don't threaten our natural resources and don't threaten public health.
Like what?
Certainly there is a robust and growing renewable energy industry, and the state of Illinois just last year passed the Future Energy Jobs Act that we think will spur significant investment in both renewables and energy efficiency efforts. That said, we recognize that there is a significant natural resource in southeastern Illinois, and there was fracking going on in this state before these rules moved forward. In fact, there was exactly the kind of operation that Woolsey was looking at doing in the run-up to passing the fracking rules in 2013. Those projects were done under drilling rules that had really not changed since World War II. And the time was right in 2013 when there were a lot of companies eyeing the shale play to ensure that there were rules put in place that would put those protections in and ensure a minimal impact on public health and our resources.
That's Josh Mogerman with the National Resources Defense Council. Mayor Tom, as you've heard these opinions expressed not just by the NRDC right now, but by many who are voiced concerns about the effect fracking has on their environment, I wonder how you as village president weigh that against, as you said, the very real need for economic opportunity and employment in your town.
Well, some of Josh's arguments are true. I think our state needs, state of Illinois needs renewable energy, needs coal, natural gas.
Right. From your perspective, we need all of these, right? That's from your perspective.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. And another thing, this well probably would have been the most watched oil project ever in the country, just for it being Illinois' first
permitted fracking project.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I wasn't really personally, I wasn't really too concerned about. I felt that the
impacts. I'm afraid, Tom, I'm afraid I'm going to have to stop you there because okay. I'm afraid we're out of time.
Okay.
But I appreciate you joining us. It's Tom Harbor. He's the village president of Enfield in Southern Illinois. Thanks for being with me.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When it comes to corruption, we know that in Illinois is unfortunately known very well for this particular type of crime, especially when it comes to government. A new film from Kurtemkin explores the biggest theft of public funds in Illinois history. For more than 20 years, former Dixon, Illinois Comptroller Rita Crundwell embezzled almost $54 million. She lived lavishly, throwing parties, investing in very expensive horses, all while the town of Dixon, that's about 40 miles southwest of Rockford, by the way, struggled to make ends meet financially. And in 2012, when her actions came to light, she pleaded guilty and was sentenced to almost 20 years in prison. There's a new film, as we said, that explores the story and the lasting effects it's had on the town of Dixon.
Rita, how did you go to bed and not think, whose lives I'm infecting here?
Just one of the citizens from Dixon that's captured by the film's director, Kelly Richmond Pope, who's with me now in our Chicago studios. Hi, Kelly. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
On the line with us from Rockford is Sue Stevens from WNIJ. She's been reporting on the Rita Crundwell case as well. Hey, Sue, welcome back to the 21st.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Kelly, let's start with you. How did you first hear about this story?
Well, I first heard about it just like everyone else, reading the news in the morning, reading the newspaper, and I saw it in the Tribune, and I was like, wow, this story is amazing. And I remember the headline said $30 million embezzled by city comptroller, and I just had to know more.
And actually, of course, it got up to $54 million, actually $53.7 to be exact, and that's an enormous sum of money. And in fact, for many years, just from the period from 2006 to 2012, she actually stole half of the city's operating budget. Let's play a little bit from your film. It's one of the people that you interviewed.
My first thought was, Dixon has that much money? That you could embezzle that much money from a little tiny place like this?
Kelly, were people surprised?
People were very surprised. But, you know, it's interesting because a lot of us don't know a lot about the finances of the place that we live. And so unless you are going to city council meetings and reading financial statements, there's probably a lot that we all would be surprised about.
That's Kelly Richmond Pope. The film's called All the Queen's Horses, by the way. And Kelly, I think the first question everybody has when they hear these stories is, how could something like this happen?
Well, I think a couple things. When you have a trusted employee and you have very few internal controls, it's easy. And what's interesting about this case is it's the largest municipal fraud in U.S. history. So not just in Illinois, but just in the U.S. At large. So I think when you trust a person, you don't follow up on what they say, and you have very few internal controls, then things like this can happen. You know, I'm a CPA. And so people like to see me coming into an organization because they're like, oh, she knows the numbers and we'll leave her alone. And whatever I say or anybody like me typically goes. So when you put that much trust in any one person, be careful.
And that's not really how financial, that's kind of the whole point of financial controls, how they're set up, right, Kelly? Sue, I wonder if you can jump in here and you can just paint a picture for us. What state was Dixon in financially during the years that this fraud was going on?
Surprisingly bad. And I think one of the really the things that was stressed in this movie, too, that was really shocking was the city next door, Sterling, had even warned them, like, why are you guys so broke? You're just like us. We are doing fine. Why are you guys so broke? And that was ignored. Unsure what happened to that advice. But, yeah, they were, roads weren't getting repaired. Pools were closing. It was just the town was getting pretty shabby, and people wondered. And it was people blamed, you know, the state budget. Oh, state's not reimbursing. There are so many different ways people, you know, came up with excuses.
Well, and that's what she said, right, Sue? And Kelly, yeah. I wonder if you can jump in here. She actually said at a certain point, well, we know that the state is late paying its bills, and she was taking the money.
Right. And it was during the recession. So all of that made sense. You know, that was a really good response to a great question. And when it's coming from your finance person, you accept it at face value. And we tend to do that.
And when you think about that also, so not only was that sort of a little bit of how she did it, and all the Queen's horses, there's a very specific reason why you have that name for the film. Kelly, can you tell us how the amount of the, I mean, a really lavish lifestyle that she was living that the people in Dixon didn't know about?
Well, her two worlds really didn't communicate. So she was this number one equestrian breeder, you know, won 52 world championships. And then she had this city job, you know, so she was the comptroller. And those two worlds never really spoke. So it was easy to hide out because you didn't have a crossover between her two lives. Now, there were a lot of rumors. People wondered where her money came from. But how do you ask a question about someone's money, and who do you ask? So I don't think that people were completely clueless. They what do you do when you have a question like that? Who do you really ask? You might think it might be gossip in the coffee shop, but what are you going to do with the information?
And so people didn't ask those questions. Can you, Sue, I wonder if you can jump in and say, when did the investigation actually start happening and how did this come to light?
Rita Crenwell was off on another one of her, she would take extended vacations to go show these horses. And man, she was a showwoman. She loved doing this. These are very fancy horses, a lot of, a lot of money you could tell would be sunk into this. So she would go, you know, take a month off and someone would fill in for her during that time. And the person who filled in to her this time was Kathy Swanson. And when she started looking through the books, she discovered this account that nobody knew about, that she couldn't identify. It was a secret account. And that's when she went to the mayor and started to, luckily he took her seriously too and called the FBI wondering what was going on there. And then the part that's just so hard to imagine is they had to hold their tongues for 6 months.
Right.
And not tell, you know, anyone that this investigation was going on. And meanwhile, more and more money would be disappearing too.
And Kelly, so that's the Dixon City clerk, Kathy Swanson. She's really central to the film. Also, this is a really small town. Everybody knows Rita. Everyone knows each other. They knew her family. Can you describe a little bit of the role that Kathy played in all of this?
Sure. Kathy was key. And when we hear about these fraud stories or fraud schemes, after you get over the fact that someone stole the money, the next question, the second question is, well, who discovered it? And so I knew that it was really important to talk to Kathy because that's the question. Like, how was it discovered? What did you do? How did you feel? And so understanding the emotions that Kathy went through, I thought was really important. And so she becomes really the queen, if you will, of the story.
And how did you find her?
I like to say strategically stalking. I for probably 4 years. I mean, it took a long time to secure the interview with Kathy. And it was really until that interview that I felt like, yes, this is going to be a great documentary. Without Kathy, it would just have been a couple of interviews and people just, you know, sharing their story and opinion. But Kathy was key. And so the film really centers around her. It's about what Rita did. It's about her crime, but it's really centered around Kathy's courageous act of coming forward.
That's Kelly Richmond Pope. She's the filmmaker for All the Queen's Horses. It's actually playing in Chicago at the Gene Siskel Film Center at the Art Institute right now. It's playing today, Wednesday, Friday, next Wednesday. And we're talking with Kelly and Sue Stevens. She's a reporter with WNIJ in Rockford, pretty close to Dixon, Illinois, where all of this happened. Kelly, can we go back to Kathy for a minute? Because as you said, she's sort of the central character. And in the film, you really sort of see the emotional toll that all of this takes on her. Because we don't, when we hear about these crimes, we also, you know, you ask, as you said, you ask the questions, right? You ask, how did this happen? Who found out about it? But we don't really often talk about the emotional toll that it takes on people.
And I thought it was really important to see that. And you don't. Often the victims are left out because the perpetrator, that's where the sensational story is, you know, what they spent the money on, how they lived this lavish lifestyle. But there was a town left in pain and hurt. And so hearing from the residents and understanding Kathy's role when she kept quiet for so long, or even just turning in your superior. I mean, even just that is tough. And if you really put yourself in her shoes and think about, have you ever turned in someone that you have to report to? That's not easy. And so I thought that she was just so important. We actually did screenings in Dixon a few weeks ago, and to a sold out audience in the historic Dixon Theater, which was great. It was free to the public. Brought to us by BMO Harris Bank and Workiva. I just thought it was really important for the citizens to see it and it to be free for them. Kathy received an Ethical Courage Award from the NASBA Center for the Public Trust, received a standing ovation because everyone was happy as to what she did.
And what else? But people are happy about what she did. How are people still feeling right now in Dixon about everything else?
I think that there were so many unanswered questions, and it made me feel really good that the documentary gave them closure and answered so many questions, because I think the reporting of this story oftentimes was so focused, Rita's life, Rita's horses, look how many parties, look at the real estate, look at the jewelry she had. But there was such a larger story that needed to be told. And so they asked questions. We had a Q&A after the screening. I think the first night it was like an hour, hour and a half.
Well, what kind of reaction? What was the tone of that?
So the main two questions were, do I think that there were any co-conspirators? Do I think that she did it alone? And all the evidence shows that the scheme was committed alone, but there were definitely people that benefited from the monies that she stole, but she committed the crime by herself. So that was one question. The other question was, did I think she received a fair sentence? She received 19 years and 7 months in prison. There were questions about what an audit does versus what an audit doesn't do. It was good, you know, just to explain some of those things. And I'm an accounting professor by training. So to be able to have people ask me those questions and be able to explain it in a clean, easy way made me feel like the film is doing the right thing.
As we talk about that, we have a little bit more from All the Horses that I wanted to play, the Queen's Horses, sorry. Let's hear a little bit of that.
This is the defendant's trophy room. Not many people have a herd of 400 show horses, many world champion horses. Our interest would be to try to get all $53 million. I don't know that the herd's ever going to bring anything close to that. Our purpose today is to let the prospective buyers know that what we have here is a very valuable herd.
So that's a moment where officials are trying to sell the horses that she bought, millions of dollars worth of horses, in order to try to help get some money back to the town of Dixon. Sue, are they even close? I mean, what does the recovery look like in terms of recovery efforts financially?
They didn't do too badly. About $40 million, and a lot of that came from suing auditors and people who should have been able to stop it. But a lot of, I think it was about $10 to $12 million came from auctioning off her stuff. These horses, the one that sold for the most was $750,000. But I was there that day, and it was just horse after horse. It was just an amazing thing to get to experience and see and understand. This is where Dixon's money was going, was sinking into these horses and the breeding of these horses. You know, she still actually makes money off the licensing of these horses. That one that brought in $775,000 has since died, but his sperm lives on and they keep selling it. So
wow.
It's just a very different world. But what I really loved, I was at that first showing with that Kelly did in Dixon, and the way the audience, I think people went into it trepidatiously.
Absolutely.
You know, they were, you know, here we go again. Some, you know, the world's going to beat us down for being dumb hicks, you know, who could lose this kind of money. But you did it so respectfully. And like you said, they had questions about the process. And it was really nice to see the warm reaction that you got from the audience for this film.
I was excited. I was nervous. I can tell you I was nervous because, you know, it's me. I'm an outsider.
You're from Chicago.
You know, I'm telling this story. But what I wanted them to realize is we're using Dixon as a lens to have a much larger conversation about how this can happen anywhere. This isn't a Dixon story. This is an everywhere, anybody story. And so I hope that came through when they
Absolutely.
Saw the film.
I want to thank both of you ladies for being with me. Kelly Richmond Pope is the filmmaker. All the Queen's Horses is playing in Chicago today, Wednesday, Friday, next Wednesday at the Gene Siskel Film Festival. Kelly, this might be available online as well for people eventually.
Yeah, 2018, hopefully.
Okay, great. I want to thank Sue Stevens as well from NIJ in DeKalb. Thanks for being with us, Sue.
It was great. Thanks.
That does it for us today. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking on the program. We're going to be joined by the Bad Food Bible's Dr. Aaron Carroll. He's going to give us his common sense approach to eating. Do you have questions about eating? You can leave us a voicemail at 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. You can email us, talk@21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.